content de vous voir aujourd'hui. Dieu nous a donné un jeu magnifique. Moi, je suis très content à cause de ça. Il y a quelqu'un ici qui parle français? My question was, yeah? So if you ask that question in English, does anyone here speak French? People are like, oh, yeah, you know, I took it in high school. Then you say something like, oh, yeah, no, not like that. So what I said was, hello, everyone. God gave us a beautiful day today, and I'm rejoicing in it. It's really great to be here. And we count it a privilege to represent you. Tonight, I was going to do something a little different. I had slides and I was going to do regular message, but I think I'm just going to tell you what's been going on and report. You know, in 1 Samuel chapter 30, there's a really kind of a famous story that bears influence on our relationship. Is honestly, church planting is God's multi-level marketing plan. You know, as each church bears fruit, that is fruit from the original church that planted it, that planted it, and that planted it. And I just think that's an amazing thing. The story, it's probably, you probably know the story. You know, David was in exile, and he got back from battle, and the Amalekites had invaded his town, Ziklag, and had taken the women captives, had looted the town, and so they're in distress. He and his men of war are in distress. Even though he's in distress, you know what he wants to do. He's a warrior. He wants to pursue. But he doesn't just do that. He asks of God, what should I do? Which is an important point. It isn't always clear. I mean, you think, okay, this is what we obviously should do. You still should ask. Ask God, what's going on here? God says, yes, go get them. And so they go get their stuff. They bring the women back. And when they come back, in 1 Samuel chapter 30, in verse 22, begin at the end of verse 21, David came near to the people. He saluted them. These are the people who couldn't go. They were too tired. They didn't want to go. They stayed by the stuff. You know that expression? Verse 22, it says, then answered all the wicked men and the men of Belial of those that went with David and said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. And David said, you shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord has given us. That's an important point. The Lord has given us, who hath preserved us and delivered the company into the company that came against us into our hand. For who will hearken unto you in this matter? And this is important. But as is his part that goeth down to the battle, so is his part that staved tears by the stuff, that they shall part alike. I know it so well, it's hard to. I still struggle with English. We don't use it very often. The only time Barbara and I ever speak English is to each other. And if there's anyone in the room that's not an English speaker, we speak French to each other. So you start to lose vocabulary after a while. But I think you understand the principle. And David established it as a principle. If you go down into battle, the people who sent you, the people who supported you are away, you share in the benefit of that. Well, we were approved in 1986. As missionaries to Zaire. It had originally been the Belgian Congo. It was a colony. Terrible, terrible, terrible history. And it became Zaire when it got their independence. And Mobutu was the president. And we moved there to a city of 6 million people. I'm from Kansas City. Kansas City's 2 million. You know, and 6 million people. None of them look like us. I couldn't say bonjour in a way that anyone could understand it. And we didn't know a living soul. Young missionaries now ask us, like, why would you do that? It's like, well, there was no alternative. There were no telephones. I didn't have anybody to write to, anybody to contact. I didn't know anybody. And so we arrive, my three blonde children, and looking really blonde in this new place. And we're at the airport. We don't even know how we're going to get into the city. We're at the airport, and they're kind of looking at me. And I'm looking at God, like, you know, what next? And Barbara saw a guy standing outside the glass, and he had a piece of torn off cardboard, and in charcoal, he had written M period Tim, Monsieur Tim. She said, you think that's us? I'm like, how could it be us? So I went out there, and I said, you know, I'm Tim. Are you looking for me? And he said, you know, are you the missionary? I said, yeah, yeah, let's go. Like, I don't know who he was or where we were going, but okay, we got in his car. And, you know, what else are we going to do? We didn't have any plan. And what had happened was somebody had heard through the grapevine that we were coming, and there was a Baptist family stationed at the embassy there, and they had contacted somebody that had a driver, and they came and picked us up and took us to the embassy garage, and we stayed with them while we were in Kinshasa. I couldn't have planned that if I had wanted to, but I learned right away God goes before you. You may remember, I used to say a lot, and because it sounds real pious, you know, your prayer is more important than your money. When you're raising money, you're in the back of your mind, it's like, but you know we need money, right? But then when you get there and you realize, oh, wow, that's really true. Your prayer is more important than your money. We are alive today because of the prayers of God's people. The list of the times that we should have died is long. It's long. And God just is always there. So we began working, you know, we started learning French. Come to find out, people on the street can speak French, but they don't. They speak their own languages. And so we began learning Lingala. That was the first language that I spoke. And it's real simple. It's the difficulty is that it's not rich. And so you have one verb for I like, I want, I need, I desire, I love. It's all one verb. And so that's context. If you say ngainalingi mai, I want water, I need water, okay, that's pretty clear. But if you say it about something else, you'll be like, I don't know. Does he want to eat it or wear it? I don't, you know, anyway. I was learning this language, and it went pretty well, and so we began planting churches. And church planting in Congo is amazing. It's so fruitful. I often say facetiously, throw a Bible over there, a church will grow. It was crazy. So once we won a few people and we kind of started building a team, we would go into a neighborhood and just start knocking on doors. And initially, I was thinking, man, this is amazing. Man, people are getting saved all the time. And it finally got to where you're like, if you knocked on a door and someone would get saved, you're like, what's with these people? I mean, seriously, almost every house, someone would get saved, if not all of them. And so in a couple of weeks, we'd have our very first service. There'd be 200 or 300 people there in the very first service. It was amazing. I'm from a little church in Kansas. I never dreamt I'd be associated with something like this. And we're planting churches. And one day, a guy came by our house. Our house sat on a corner. When we first got there, we didn't have any money, you know, and we didn't know how to do things, and so everything is custom. Like, you have to have your furniture built, you have to have your curtains made and all that. So we got to be known as the house with no curtains. And then people would just walk by and look in our windows, and it got to be where, like, you didn't want to come out of the bedroom in the morning to go to the kitchen because somebody would see you, and they'd be starting, Madame, Madame, like, at 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, people were always by our gate. It was a parade of people with needs. You know, like I said, I'm from Kansas. Sure, there are people around soliciting, they're begging, whatever. But it wasn't like that. I mean, this is, my children have eaten in 3 days. You know, my mother's dying. It was just terrible, terrible stuff. Well, one day a guy shows up and he has a letter. And the letter essentially said, would you please come to our town and start one of those Baptist churches? I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, of course we will. Yeah, I mean, do you know anybody that's ever received a letter from a chamber of commerce and said, would you please come start one of those Baptist churches in our town? I know people that received a letter from the chamber saying, we don't need any more churches in our town. You know, and so I'm filing it away thinking, hey, you know, we'll get this trip planned with one of our trips up country because we were working in the city and we were working up country. And I no more than got that one put away, and another one came. And man, I'm getting before long, a collection of these. We worked with, I guess missionary strategists would call it web relationships. So let's say, you know, the pastor gets saved. He probably needs to. The pastor gets saved, and, he's not really from here, but he knows people where he came from that need to be saved too. So he says, hey, can we go, like, talk to them? Like, sure. So we go talk to them, and they get saved, and, well, they know people over there. And before long, you've built this web that's all interconnected. Huge opportunities. And these letters just kept coming. We're planting churches. You know, we're busy. We're planting churches. And one day, we were getting near the end of our term, and we knew we were going to be leaving before long. And this letter came, and I really just said, Lord, what am I supposed to do with this? We don't have the resources for this. We don't have the people. We don't have the money to get there. And I don't know if you've ever been faced with that. The reality that money is going to keep the gospel from going someplace. That is a tragic. I don't know how to describe it better, but it is a terrible situation. to be in. For the want, I have an illustration, for the want of a few dollars, just to put fuel in a vehicle or to pay someone's way to go, or the want of a few dollars. You know, I was in business for a long time. I was in the printing and publishing business. And, you know, I know a lot about money. I'm not very good with money, but I know a lot about money. And if you can show me an investment better than when you drop this in the offering plate, somehow God turns that into human souls. Folks, that's amazing. That is amazing. If you show me something better than that, I am interested. It counts in eternity. This by itself, and what can you do with this anymore? I remember years ago, I was in New England, I was in Connecticut or somewhere, and I got a cup of coffee and I threw a dollar down. This was a long time ago. And the guy looked at me like, it's more than a dollar? I'd been away a while. And he said, yeah, it's like $1.25. Are you kidding? I mean, you can't even, now how much is a cup of coffee? I stopped the other day, it was $3 at Love's. But in the hands of my God, it is life-changing. And it means something. A war came to Kinshasa. War is not the right term, really, but for lack of a better term, when it started in downtown Kinshasa, the morning after it fired up, there were 250 dead bodies laying in the street downtown. It was just a nightmare. We tried to stay, and we tried to go back over and over again, and there's a long story about how hard we tried to do that. I was there again looking for a house just before we finally decided we couldn't do that, and it flared up again, and I spent a week under gunfire at my friend's house, and just, you know, I don't know how many nights since I've been a missionary that I've spent under gunfire, but a lot. It just, you know, would I lay down my life for the gospel? Absolutely. Without hesitation, in a moment, I would not hesitate. When the warlord took my car, you know, and I was there in the war zone in Bouake. This is another country years later, okay? Don't get too confused. When he took my car, you know, one of the other mercenaries saw me in it. He wanted it. And so, man, he's threatening me and everything. He was drunk or stoned, I don't know which. And finally, I just said, look, you're stoned. I'm leaving. And I just pulled away. And his guys are like looking at me like, who are you anyway? Well, I told the warlord that had my car, you know, it's like, I know how to handle firearms. That was just a complete irresponsible use of a firearm. It's like, there's no reason for him to be threatening me like that. And, you know, and he justified it. Oh, you know, these guys are all tough. They're warriors. I said, you know, it's like, there's no excuse for that. Well, the next day they shot him in the foot to warn him, like, you need to settle down. I mean, I told him, it's like, I'm not afraid to die. I'm not even a little afraid to die, but nobody wants to die because some idiot accidentally pulled the trigger and goes, oh man, I didn't mean to do that. No one wants to die like that, you know? You want it to have meaning. Anyway, it's like, but I don't think that you have the right to make that choice for your children. And it's one thing if you're there, it's another thing if you move back into it. And so there were no schools, there were no hospitals, everything was closed, and that was when we didn't know what to do. Fully supported missionary, nowhere to go. And it made my phones ring, and missionary was like, hey, you know, consider this field. I'm like, you realize I've been through two wars, right? Like, wherever I go, there's war. And I'm like, yeah, maybe you ought to reconsider. So I'm looking through the Baptist Bible Fellowship directory and looking for missionaries. And we had already spent a year and $12,000 on language school, learning French. I wanted to use that. I didn't want to waste it. And I came to Ivory Coast. And there was one family name there, Terry and Janet Jones, with a telephone number. I'm like, no way. So we didn't have telephones. We didn't even dream of having telephones. I only knew two people with a telephone. They were businesses. You know, I called it, and he answered. And I'm like, no way. And I started asking questions, and everything was affirmative, affirmative, affirmative. That was a Sunday afternoon in August. And so I called him on his Sunday evening, and I just knew that this was where God was leading us. And so by November, we had packed a container and we were leaving, which that's amazing because we'd lost everything in Congo, filled a whole nother container, and people just gave us stuff, you know. Pastor in Oklahoma basically gave us a whole household full of furniture that he had made, and it was amazing. So we arrive, and we're thinking, what kind of place is this? We're going up a four-lane highway, Abidjan on the coast. Talking to me is like a geography lesson, okay? Abidjan is on the coast. It is the Paris of West Africa. It's the pearl of West Africa. If you can buy it in France, you can buy it in Abidjan for a price. It's an amazing place. We don't live in Abidjan, and we weren't going to live in Abidjan. So we're in an air-conditioned bus driving up a four-lane highway, and Barbara and I are looking at each other thinking, where are we? I mean, we didn't have anything like that in the Congo. So we get to Bouake, where we were going to be living. I know you all know right where that is, with this other missionary. And on the way up, I said, you know, so tell me about your work. And he said, well, you know, we really don't have anything going yet. He's been there like a year and a half or something, 2 years, I don't know. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I just moved my family here. What do you mean you don't have anything going yet? And really, he just needed a boost. And so we were together then, and, you know, by then it worked okay. But I got up in the morning, the first day, and we started driving around. I'm thinking, wow, there are a lot of mosques in this town. A lot of boo-boos. Boo-boos are the clothes they wear. To me, boo-boo was Yogi Bear's sidekick, you know. And I think, of all the questions I asked, never even occurred to me to ask about Islam. Because in Congo, it was a complete non-issue. Only one time ever did we see a group of Muslims praying someplace. Like, nobody gave it any thought. Nobody gave it a thought. It's different now, but back then it was just not. Turns out our town's 65% Muslim. Like, okay. I knew really three things, that they could have four wives, their books, the Quran, and they don't eat pork. And that was about what I knew. So I became a real serious student of Islam. And now I probably know more about it than most of them. I know more about the Quran than most of them. And we win them quite often. You know, the testimony is always the same. I get asked this a lot. How do you reach Muslims? I knew one pastor, an Iraqi, who was saved, really. He noticed Jesus in the Quran. And there are quite a few mentions of Jesus in the Quran. And he said, you know, this is pretty important in here. I better go find out more about this. And he's reading the New Testament, reading the Bible, and he got saved reading the Bible. But other than him, every Muslim I know that is converted, is a Christian now, everyone I know, their testimony is almost always the same. Nobody ever loved me like these people. My own family didn't love me like these people. And we had a young man get saved. He was sick, and his family, because they thought it was terminal, they just backed away. They weren't going to treat him anymore because there's no point in wasting money on that. And that's kind of the way in Ivory Coast. And we came to his aid as a church, and he got saved. And when he came, he got well, and he came. That was his testimony. Nobody ever loved me like you. My parents didn't love me like you. That is how you win Muslims. And so, you know, we got busy. And so we started planting churches, and we had six churches planted in around our city and a couple of other villages around. And in September of 2002, my son came knocking on my bedroom door about 5 o'clock, and he said, hey, Jim called. He said, you're hearing gunfire. Like, yeah, you know, it happens. I went back to sleep. And when I got up, I'm like, that's not gunfire. That's artillery fire. That's different. Artillery fire is a whole other thing. And there had been an attempted coup in the night, and it failed, but our town fell to the rebels and became the rebel capital. And so we were locked in there for 8 days. I can't tell you all those stories. It's really long. But we were locked down there. And finally, I was the warden, which at the time is what they called us. Now they call us citizen liaison volunteers or something. But it's I'm the link between the embassy and the American community, which at the time was pretty big in Bouake because our kids' school was there, missionary kids' school. And so we evacuated and had a chance to go back. That was in September. I had a chance to go back in January. I thought he'd be back, you know, in a few weeks. Had to go back, a chance to go back in January with a French military escort. They were going up, the officers were going up to get their things and clear out their houses. I was going up to check on how things were. So it was really funny. In this escort, it's like a rolling tank and an armored car and my little car and another rolling tank. And, you know, it just was weird. So we get there because we were really going for two things: to pull the hard drives out of our computers and get Barbara's KitchenAid, just the essentials, you know? I mean, you got to have what you got to have. And what I didn't know was that you had to have a pass to move around town. You couldn't just drive around. You had to have this pass. Well, the guy you get the pass from is the guy driving my car. They stole my car. And so I go up there. As yet, they're not stealing anything except cars. They're not stealing anything because they still had a little money left over from the war. It was supposed to last 3 days. Well, now we're 3 months into it, and or 4 months into it, and they're running out of money. But when I got there, I'm waiting. You know, they can make you wait because they can, so they do. And finally, you're going to see him, and he's screaming at me. He's yelling, you know, "You French, you're all a bunch of women. You didn't have to leave. Everything's fine here." And I'm thinking, yeah, it seems fine. I felt like a little kid standing in front of the principal, you know, yelling at me. And no one told me, "You're not supposed to talk to him. You're not supposed to talk. You're just supposed to listen." So there was a little lull, and I said, "Well, I'm not French." People kind of went, like, you're talking. Anyway, I said, "I'm not French. I'm an American pastor. I've lived here for 10 years. And in Africa, it's very, very important to know to whom you are speaking. Are they important? Are they not important?" And there was just this slight hesitation that passed across his face. And he starts yelling at me again. And in the next lull, I said, "You know, that's my car you're driving out there." And people are going, "Oh, man, you shouldn't have said that." I said, "You know, I just rebuilt the engine a few months ago. Here, take this money and make sure you change the oil regularly." He said, "Oh, I change the oil every 2 weeks." You know, it goes on. And I'm like, "Well, you know, just take it and go." And anyway, he gave me my pass. We got our hard drives and barbecue KitchenAid. As we're leaving, my son was with me. He was pretty traumatized by the whole thing. He was young, you know, he was probably 21 or 2. And as we're leaving, I'm like, "You know, this wasn't so bad. I think I'll come back in a couple of weeks." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm not coming back here." It was just a grace that God gave me. And as it turned out, 2 weeks later, we evacuated again. We arrived on January 7th, and we evacuated again on September 7th. At that point, I'm like, you know, I give up. And so I left Barbara in America, and I was going back and forth. And I say I commuted back and forth to Africa. So I'd go for a month or so, and I'd come back out for a couple of weeks, and I'd go for a month or so, and I'd come back out. Well, the next time I went, I thought I was going to be back in a couple of weeks. That was March, and what I found out was three of my colleagues, Baptist missionaries, were going in to clear out their houses. They were leaving for good. So I just went with them. I'm going to go home. I'm going back. And again, I had to go see the guy with my car to get my pass to drive around town. But this time when I got there, I got out and I heard all these young guys. There's always like 50 or 100 guys standing around doing nothing. They all kind of look like they probably drank beer at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, for breakfast. They all have this weird look. But they're all like, "Oh, the pastor's back. Hey, look, the pastor's here." And this time, there's no waiting to go into his office. His office is outside, okay? I say his office. It was a corrugated tin roof. He's behind this big, huge hardwood desk rolling around the dirt in a high-back leather chair. So office is an exaggeration, but that's where he worked. And he stands up and he said, "Pastor, welcome back. Welcome back." I'm like, "Man, I'm the chaplain." I mean, it was just unbelievable. And I don't know what happened, but somehow whatever God did that first trip that I was there, it made an impression on them. And I can't call him a friend. He was a monster in every sense of the word. You know, the Bible talks about Jesus having favor with God and man. I never thought about having favor with man, the man being a monster. But him driving my car and me being known by him facilitated me being able to stay when everybody else was gone. When I was in town, everybody knew it because I was the only pale face in town. Hundreds of thousands of people. And so they knew when I was there and they knew when I wasn't there. So we're all scattered. And we finally, a year later, we moved to Yamoussoukro. Again, I know you know right where that is. It's about an hour south of where we were living before, just outside the front of the war. All our pastors are scattered all over the place. And so then we began redeploying, as you would. We had one church that was in a village that was outside the war zone that was still in existence. The rest of them were all done, all gone. All stuff was gone, everything. I visited one of them. It looked like we had moved away. I mean, there's a couple pieces of paper blowing around on the floor. Everything was gone, everything. Doors, windows, everything. So we began redeploying and planting new churches, and now those churches are planting churches on their own. And last year, and the orphanage started really as a result of the war. So many people were killed. Between AIDS victims and war victims, there just were a lot of orphan children There's also a lot of very dark things in the culture that create orphans. They're not really orphans, but they would be dead if they weren't with us. If in one case, we have a little girl who, she came as a newborn. Her mother was very young. And so if a baby is born to a girl who hasn't been through her initiation yet, which is a tribal thing, she hasn't been through her initiation yet, then the baby's supposed to die. It's a spiritual thing. They don't think it's a real baby. And so, I can't even get into all that. But so the paternal grandfather is going to get the baby to sacrifice the baby. The maternal grandmother hears about it. She goes and gets the baby and brings the baby to us. So the paternal grandfather cannot know that she's there. And so now that she's school age, that's a complicated thing. We're usually going to the school and kind of clandestinely explaining what the deal is. You just need to let her go to school and, we'll work out the details later. Because once she gets old enough, it won't be an issue, or her grandfather passes away. But a lot of them come like that. And so that was really partly as a result of the war, partly as just a result of culture. And God is doing some amazing things there too. Just lately, kids have been getting married that grew up there, and it's just an exciting thing. I met a wedding last week. The young man grew up in the orphanage. And when he finished law school, he couldn't find a job. And so he just went to a well-known law firm and said, hey, I'll work for free. I just want to learn the business. And they said, sure, we'll let you work for free. you would think like, no, we'll give you something. Oh, no, they let him work for free, absolutely for free. But they found out he's honest and he works hard and he's really smart. And now he manages that office, and driving a BMW. That's just the African dream. We have our American dream. That's the African dream, drive BMW. In September last year, I had the opportunity to go back to the Congo to visit. They searched me out, and one of the young men who was a child when I lived there is now a judge, and he was a lawyer then. He was waiting to become a judge, but he is a judge now, and there are a couple others that were doctors, and this committee sought me out, wanted me to come and visit the village and see what all we could do. Anyway, I went, and that was the most thrilling thing. And this is what I really want you to hear. I was meeting pastors that had heard that there used to be a missionary here, but they didn't know me. I didn't know them. And come to find out, which I was aware of some of this, and I have been for a while, but the churches that we planted had all of them planted at least one other church. Those churches had all planted churches that had planted churches. That had planted churches. On any given Sunday, there are more than 30,000 people that attend those churches. And we part alike. That is all fruit that is attributed to our account. One day, you hear this a lot, but I so believe it. One day, you're going to meet people from someplace way up country in the Congo that no white man has ever been, that got to go there because you partnered with a missionary who took the light to them. Folks, that is an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. As I said, I'm from a little church in Kansas. I never dreamt that God would do something like this. I'm not one of those missionaries that God had to threaten me to get me to be a missionary. He had some work to do on me. I was so lazy, man. I was so lazy. And I worked harder at not working than I did if I'd just done the job. I was just lazy. The printing business beat that out of me because it's a deadline business, and I learned how to work, and now I love work. There's nothing I'd rather do than work. I love it. But God had to groom me for that. A few years ago, a missionary that left Ivory Coast, he was a missionary kid, had grown up in West Africa, and I preached in his church in North Carolina, and when he introduced me, he said something that shocked me. He said, "This is the hardest working missionary I have ever known." I'm like, "Are you kidding me? I feel pretty lazy." There's got to be other people that work much harder than me. God just put us in this. And I said, as I said, I'm not one of those guys that God had to threaten me to be a missionary. I longed to be a missionary. I dreamt of being a missionary. I've said in our video, 1984, we were praying. I was the music leader, you know, and I'm standing up here, and we're praying God calls some missionaries from our church. And I'm looking around saying, man, that couple's sharp. They'd be great missionaries. That guy, he's awesome. He'd be a great missionary. And in my heart, I'm saying, God, let be me. Let be me. Well, that year, I think God finally said, Downs, if you'll just shut up, you can go to Congo. You know, we didn't know where we were going to go. We just knew we wanted to be missionaries. I still remember, we think about it a lot. We had a new house. We had new cars. The business was good, you know. I mean, the ministry was going well, and it was a good time in our lives. And I walked up behind Barbara in the kitchen in her new house, and I said, you know, I think God may be calling us to Africa. She said, oh? And I thought, enough said. I'll just let that simmer for a while. Let God do his thing now, you know. And she knew that one day we'd be going someplace. Who knows where. But I just believe that you should bloom where you're planted. I always say, man, if I had 50 lives, I could place them in 2 minutes. It wouldn't be in America. I'm sorry. But, I mean, there are just so many places in need. In Congo right now, they are clamoring for missionaries. I told them the same thing that I've been telling myself. Man, this is a young man's task. That's a young man's task. And God laid on my heart recently about an area of our city, a place called Morofe. It's kind of a neighborhood in Yamoussoukro, but very fast growing. Every time we go out there, there's a new apartment building, there's a group of new houses. They're just really fast growing that needs a church. And I'm thinking, but man, that's a young man's task. Church planting is grueling. There is nothing that Satan fights more than the planting of new churches, because that is God's plan for this age. It is by that means that the gospel is to get out, is through churches. But this is the time I have left. You know, my dad used to jokingly tell a story about a guy 80 years old, and he was learning Greek. And people would say, why would you learn Greek at 80 years of age? He said, this is the only age I have left, you know? Well, that's where I'm at. Like, why would you start a church now at your age? Like, this is the age I have. I don't want to coast to the finish. I want to finish hard, and I want to be spent. I was on a board in France for a while, and the French are all about, you know, don't work too hard. And I just said one time, you know, it's like, I want to be spent. I want to get to the end of my life with nothing left. I want it to be gone, done, having never saved back a thing for the glory of God. So pray with us when we get back. Barbara's pretty encouraged about it. I think she's tired of not being a pastor's wife because she can't make all the decisions. But we're pretty excited about planning a new church. We'll be building a team when we get back in January. And pray that God goes before us, which we have experienced that so many times. We know he will. Thank you once again. We're so proud, so honored to represent you. And know that God is doing a work, and he's doing a work because of this partnership. Let's pray.